And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And in honor of using the traditional intro and the kicky music, the entire band is back together around the table again today for the show.
We're on a mission from GAD.
And as you might expect, you might have heard about a little pop culture event called the Hunger Games movie. Mm. We are going to talk about it because you have to, because if we don't, then they come and arrest us and make us fight each other to the death. And we decided not to do that.
We all know who would win.
Yeah.
We're also going to bring back one of our very favorite repeat segments, and we'll get to that a little bit later. And of course, we will end the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And back from his sick bed, Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
When I am not hacking up a lung, I am the movies editor for NPR.org.
Only when you're not hacking up a lung.
Yeah, that's right. Otherwise.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I occasionally write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm very happy to see all of you back. And I assume we all did the assignment. We have all seen the Hunger Games movie.
Yes, we have.
Now, before we get started, I think I'm going to say that if, of course, you have not read the book, it's pretty much inevitable that we're going to wind up spoiling the plot of the book slash movie.
People die.
We are going to talk about the book and
we're
going
to talk about the book and the movie. If you haven't either seen the movie or read the book and you choose to cut out, we will understand. All right, Glenn, let's start with you. What was your initial reaction to the movie?
It was fine. It was fine. I wasn't hungering for this movie because I thought the book was fine and I liked the book just fine. And my favorite thing about the book was its pacing, which is a kind of a thing that's kind of tough to capture. Because when you're reading the book, you feel like you're in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing, because every chapter is built toward the final sentence of the chapter.
Right.
Everything is sort of leading you, funneling down this slaughterhouse right to this final sentence, which is usually a single sentence paragraph. That is engineered, genetically engineered, to get you to turn the page.
Mm-hmm.
So when you feel that, you feel like, I am in good hands here. This movie had pacing that I just didn't understand. It was awfully slow at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, the very final fight scene just went really quick. But
And a sequence that is drawn out in an agonizing way in the book.
Absolutely.
That final fight.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of all about wearing people down and deciding how long you're going to just stick it out.
Just in general, I liked it fine. Am I hankering for the next movie? No, because I know what happens and the book is fine, but that's kind of where I am. I don't have a strong feeling about
that. I'm hankering. First of all, I mean, obviously I'm on record. I love the book. It's one of the few books I've read.
You keep saying that. It makes people think you can't read.
Right. No, I realize that. Okay, I've had it read to me. I actually, after seeing the movie with my son on Saturday, I immediately went home and read all of Catching Fire in one gigantic gulp. So it certainly, if nothing else, sort of stoked my appetite for more of this story. I completely agree with Glenn about the pacing. I mean, I think in a way the book is paced almost a little bit like a television show, where the end of each chapter kind of functions as like act break. So that, you know, in the case of TV shows, you're going to stay through the commercials. But in the case of the book, you immediately like glomped the next page. The movie sort of naturally isn't able to do that, and I'm not sure how effective it would be if it did, because so many of the people who are excited to see this movie have read the books, and so those surprises are not going to be surprises. A lot of the act of making this movie is sort of how faithfully can we adapt this book so that we're able to paint the picture of this story that readers have in their heads.
Right. How do we realize the world of this story in a way that's satisfying to these fans?
And as a fan of the book, I was satisfied.
You were good with the physicality of it?
I was, yeah.
The visuals.
I mean, it's a 2-hour and 25-minute movie.
Yep.
And, you know, you really don't want that movie to be much longer than that. So, you know, I understand some of the things that got kind of clipped. But I did feel like the story of Katniss and Gale is very Cliff's Note-y. You don't have these kind of lyrical passages where they're in the woods sort of knowing each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't quite get the weight of what that relationship means to her in comparison to this other relationship.
I would say, actually, that that's one of the film's great weaknesses, is that you don't get a very strong sense of what anyone means to her, except possibly the little sister.
Right.
But that's because that so much of what the book does well is about Katniss being in her own head. It's about her remembering things or wondering about someone else's motivations or second-guessing her own feelings and her intentions. It is difficult to the point of impossibility to put that kind of internal monologue on screen.
Right.
So it's a hurdle that the film was probably destined not to get over. But to me, it's the thing that sort of most took the appeal out of the story.
Well, you have the challenge with a book like this being transferred into a movie of how do you handle the gaping mouthfuls of exposition
right.
that are required to tell the story. You have to establish sort of as quickly as possible and in as few words as possible the entire story of this dystopian future
mm-hmm. yep.
and what are these districts and what is this government and what happened and where are they and who are these people and what is District 12 versus District 4.
Right.
So they resorted to the last refuge of the scoundrel screenwriter, which is the TV anchor.
Sure.
I thought they handled it, I think, as best they could, but the fact that you didn't sort of have Jennifer Lawrence doing endless voiceover.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Right, which would have been deadly.
That
right.
Been
it would have. It would have. I did feel like if I had been making it, I would have compressed more in the early middle mm-hmm. part mm-hmm. after the reaping and before the games. Mm-hmm. Would have done without so much of the training sequences, so mm-hmm. much of perhaps the pageant sequences, maybe figure out a way to make that shorter and left more space at the end for a couple of other things to breathe.
Especially the part where they set that training montage to Taking Care of Business.
Yes. Came out of nowhere.
That is a filthy lie. One of which is that ending mm-hmm. sequence. Mm-hmm.
I thought it ended kind of weirdly abruptly.
It did end weirdly abruptly. And the other is the relationship with Rue, which is very short
in the
book. And
20 minutes of screen time in the movie.
It's very short in the movie.
It just felt like it took forever for her to die.
Really?
And then we're going like, now we're getting flowers now?
Oh, come see, I was actually going to complain about that. That's one of the other things that really bugged me is that, you know, a lot of people have talked about the way the film cuts away from the violence to, you know, keep within the bounds of a PG-13. But the thing that really, really struck me, and I've only read the book once, but I remember after Rue dies, the mourning sequence was so rich and so moving mm-hmm. that I felt like what they did on screen was really shorthanded.
Well, the other thing is that sequence, too, plays a big part in one of the other things that I thought got really shortchanged in the movie, which is the development of Katniss's folk hero
mm-hmm.
Right. standing.
And the way the people watching
right.
TV respond.
And my recollection is that the business with Rue and the flowers and all of that played a big role in her being seen in a certain way mm-hmm. by people who were watching this terrible display on television. Right.
Particularly stoking serious resentment in District 11.
And revolt. Yeah. And I felt like there is a short scene of rebellion mm-hmm. that is kind of asked to carry the entire story of how Katniss and her personality and how people are taking to her, how that is affecting the political mood in the entire country, which is what makes her a threat. And so
right.
when you haven't set that part up, then the part at the end when sort of they figure out how it's going to end and they figure out how they're going to avoid kind of the central horror of the mm-hmm. of what you think they're going to at the end, when she figures out how to sort of circumvent elements of what they intend to do, it feels like a very huge rebellious thing to do. But that's partly because she's already developing a following.
Yep.
It's almost like the Truman Show. She's already got all these people kind of cheering and excited and invested specifically in her.
Yep.
I think in the book there's a little bit more with her trying to get gifts.
Yeah,
and
she gets
like
the threads that are missing in the movie that are there in the book is after Rue's death and after, I think, one other development. She specifically gets gifts from the assembled masses
right.
of these other districts.
Right, and I think the problem is when you haven't developed that,
right.
then that ending where she kind of messes up the program,
mm-hmm.
it does not feel as much like, oh, wow, they are going to really... Because in the book, I remember, you get to the end and it's like, wow, they are really going to get her for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And she is going to be in big, big trouble. Whereas in the movie, I kind of felt like they sort of told you she would be, but it didn't feel as big. And it's partly because they rushed through that closing sequence.
Right.
Well, and I think they also tried to get a little bit of a shortcut to that in doing something that obviously the book couldn't do, which is they occasionally broke from her perspective.
Sure. Yes.
The books are told entirely from Katniss's Alice's point of view. Mm-hmm. And so everything is filtered through her eyes and what she knows. Mm-hmm. And the movie, at a couple of points, they're a little bit jarring. Suddenly you have the scene with President Snow, and he's
in the control room.
And he's sort of explaining his theories on hope versus fear.
And we can't let them have too much hope.
Donald Sutherland, the only person in the universe of this film who doesn't have carefully manicured facial hair.
Sure. And so, you know, I think they kind of decided to break away from her perspective in order to provide a little bit of shorthand. And my guess is that when they try to adapt Catching Fire, which I just read, you're going to probably see more and more of that.
I don't know if we needed those scenes. Let's put in the dogs from Ghostbusters. I don't think we needed those.
One of the places where they do that, and it is absolutely an attempt to bring home this point that Linda was making, that, you know, the stakes of what she's done, to at the end of the film, they do something that obviously doesn't happen in the books, not that I remember anyway, which is what they do, and without wishing to give it away entirely, but what happens to the game designer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Nice. Yes, I think that's...
Nicely telegraphed.
Yeah. I kind of was looking for some more set pieces. I thought they handled the reaping really, really well. Yes. That was really...
That's a lovely sequence, and it's devastating.
Devastating and silent and not pushing it too hard.
And
really
quick.
Nice. Yeah. The other thing that was really good was the bloodbath at the cornucopia when the games began. And then since that, they got into some fight scenes where the shaky cam and you don't know who's fighting who and what's happening. But where it lost me was had nothing to do with the story, but really about the production design. In my head, the production design was much better because the dichotomy between the district and the capital was huge in my head, and what we got on screen was more Appalachia versus Vegas. And I can remember that that in the book, the capital was a place of decadence and not just like pink hair and wigs, but like genetic mutations and gadgets.
I expected more crazy faces.
Right. And so when they went up into their hotel, I was like, oh, we're going to get some science fiction techno. Oh, we're in a Kimpton hotel. Okay. They're at the W.
That's interesting because one of the things I complained about when I saw it was that the scenes in District 12 at the beginning, what you're referring to as the Appalachia, you know, which I think it literally is.
Yes.
But I felt that the blue-gray palette was actually somewhat heavy-handed. I don't know if I believe that there would not be a single... not blue or gray object in this entire country, like even a naturally occurring object. But I felt like when we got to the capital, I understood why they had done that, because they did choose that bright purple, pink, crazy color scheme for the capital. To me, the key to the capital in the book is modifications for their own sake that we would not think of as attractive, but that if you give people enough money and access, they will eventually start changing their appearance in whatever way indicates that they can and you can't. I think the point of the book is they just have to be modifications we wouldn't necessarily make. So to me, the kind of weird makeup and stuff like that did serve that function, even if it wasn't maybe as extreme as Glenn was hoping for.
Well, one of the interesting side effects of the like $1 billion worth of free media that this movie has gotten, my favorite examples of those are the a look at the capital fashions in the Hunger Games, which is sort of like how you can live more like the characters in WALL-E.
Yeah.
Right. You
know, like this
the
is
the leisure technology of WALL-E.
It is these designs in this in the fashions in this movie are supposed to be parodying this insufferable venal excess, and so I've enjoyed the embrace of that.
I did. Yeah. I was implicated. I mean, I wanted to see somebody die. There would be stretches where nobody died for like 10 minutes. To be like, well, now I understand that implicates me in the fictive universe of the bloody blah. But
But you're
okay with that.
I wanted
down
some toddlers
it.
To take a dirt nap.
Toddlers.
I think Trey sort of put his finger on what I think was the ultimate issue with the movie, which is that they had a very hard time building the relationships as richly as they did in the book. Which means I think if you see the movie, having read the book, so you know what those relationships are, it can still work very effectively for you. But I don't think the movie fully earned those relationships on its own. The relationship with Rue and with Gale, as you said. And one of the things that I really didn't like is that if you watch this movie like it's a regular YA movie, you get this very clear sense of her gradually getting closer and closer and closer and closer to PETA in this very real kind of... I meet him and then we kiss and it's fake, but it's not fake and it's right. Whereas in the book, one of the things I love about the book is she is deeply, deeply ambivalent about it. She's not sure how she feels about it. Not in a kind of
I'm not sure if I love him or not.
I don't know if I love him or not, but like she genuinely is not sure whether these are romantic feelings or not.
Right. Yeah, she's not even sure that she's capable of of romantic feelings
hers
in
is
this
not
particular
a,
realm.
Yeah, hers is not a deeply romantic story.
No.
I
mean,
There was actually a critic, I think it might have been Stephanie Zatrick, who said, ultimately, this is a story about whether a girl can trust a boy. And I was like,
No, it's not. It's a story about whether a girl can trust herself.
It's really not about that. The movie kind of falls into the trap of seeming like it is about that because it's trying to compress so much and clip out so much.
The movie's asking Jennifer Lawrence to do a lot with her face.
Yeah.
And she does a hell of a lot with her face. I mean, the final scene where she's holding up the hand of PETA in the train station is, you can see the ambivalence there. It's telegraphed.
Lots of subtext going on.
Yeah.
And we should say hers is a really terrific performance.
I mean,
I like that performance a lot, And I like a bunch of the other performances, too. I really liked Lenny Kravitz
I was just going to say, actually.
You know, he's taken a lot of heat for being, you know, this non-actor, and I thought he was nicely human.
He was lovely in it. I thought Elizabeth Banks was terrific and funny and weird in it.
Yeah, very
in
weird.
In a way that I liked, and that was very true to the sense of the book.
There was this bizarre dust-up over Rue being black.
When she is in the book.
It says dark skin.
Yeah, it does. It says dark brown skin, and it says the same thing about Thresh. And it's very, I don't know where that came from either. To me, what was weird about it was the hostility that came from it that was like, now I don't care as much.
I really like to think of that as an isolated group of nitwits.
But, I agree. I really thought the casting was good all around. I thought they got most of it right.
Which is why I'm looking forward to Finnick in the next movie. Finnick, remember Finnick?
I bet you're looking forward to Finnick.
Tall, blonde, muscular dude with a trident.
With the shirts
goes
off
shirtless
all the time, right?
All the time.
Yep. Yeah.
Not in my defense, he's 24, okay? Not like a kid. He's 24 years old, this guy.
I was a little surprised given how much attention has been paid to the soundtrack, how little music was in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I kept waiting for it.
You know, you got T-Bone Burnett producing the soundtrack. You expect his stamp to be sort of in the sound of the movie, but then it's a very generic score.
Then you'd have to, you know, figure out what are the musical styles
well, and
the
then,
place.
And then, of
you
course,
know,
I mean, you
people,
have Taylor Swift on the soundtrack.
Right.
Is Taylor Swift the voice of Katniss? I'm not so sure.
Well, I think we like the movie in many ways, and
we're
dissatisfied in other ways. And obviously, many of you have seen it, judging by the box office returns.
Right.
So
boy.
Feel free to come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH or come to the blog at npr.org/monkeysee and tell us what you thought of the movie. All right. Well, it's the middle section of our show.
It is.
And there was a time when we used to do this a little more than we have recently.
Sing the song.
But we have decided to bring you another installment of Regrettable Television Pop Quiz. So we're going to listen to some clips of some regrettable television that we've gathered. Each one has one of us who's responsible for it. And the rest of us will see if we can figure out what it is. And then maybe we'll chat a little bit about it.
Are you keeping score?
You may keep score if you like, Trey. If it's important to you. If it's important to you to win the regrettable television pop quiz. All right. Mike Katza, if you want to give us a clip.
Chantelle got fake teeth. It's changed her life.
I love my new teeth. I was so proud of when I got them. I was impressed. I was afraid they weren't going to be as pretty as they are.
She really needed them teeth.
I love them new teeth. I sure do. They're pretty. They're bright. But she needed them.
Chantel's boyfriend. I call him Carl. Some people call him Albert.
Some people call me Carl. Some people call me Albert. And really depends on what part of the country I'm in. Some people call me Jimmy.
Sounds like television's typically sensitive portrayal of people from the southern.
Did
part
I hear that right? She got new fighting teeth.
I think it was like shiny new teeth.
Oh, okay.
She just got new teeth.
I like fighting
particularly enjoyed the music.
That
Like I said, reality television is so good with people from the south. So respectful. And
this is actually a show that comes to you from the same production outfit as Glenn's favorite reality television show, The Long Island Medium.
The Long Island.
It is a show called.
I have no idea what this
anybody?
Is.
Yeah, anybody?
No
idea. This is a show called Bayou Billionaires. And full episodes of it are available for your enjoyment at cmt.com. Or you could just watch the best of clips, in one of which our hero Albert slash Jimmy slash Carl, who is the one who just said that his girlfriend really needed those new fake teeth, announces that he too is about to have all 14 of his remaining teeth extracted. Take a moment. All 14.
Wow.
All 14. Why is it called Bayou Billionaires?
Because they are they're an extended family. They live on 80 acres of land near Shreveport, and they have struck gas. Just like the Beverly Hillbillies.
Story of my life!
I know that I have talked about my connections to South Carolina and Georgia before, but it is worth reminding you people that I was actually born in New Orleans, so I feel like it's fair game for me to talk some trash about some of the more eccentric folks in Louisiana, and I am here to tell you that this is one hell of a country-ass family, and that many of their conversations revolve around improving various body parts. Teeth and boobs and hair pieces are all up in the first few episodes of this. It is apparently a surprisingly popular new reality television. It's just started airing in January. I watched a couple of complete episodes of this thing, and it's actually a little sweet under the surface. This family's kind of tight-knit. I kind of got to like them.
They're on the side of her getting the good teeth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't want her to short herself on teeth.
They're on the side of, in one episode, they're on the side of duping Albert slash Carl slash Jimmy into thinking that he has in fact made contact with aliens. But that's probably the outlier.
Fair enough. All right, my cats have flipped.
Dude, you okay? Let's get you off the horse.
I actually thought that I hit Josh in his grand cart because my lance broke. But then I get down to the end, it broke because I broke it directly on his nutsack.
How you doing in there?
Hey, you hit me right in the balls.
All right, get off.
They're still there, but it hurts like.
Yeah, that's right where it hit me. Right where this giant hole is.
Yeah, that's why if it went in there, we just need to make sure it didn't.
You can check it out, man. It's still there, so I guess they're pretty strong. 4 testicles.
You were bad luck, Tom.
I am so sorry. Are you all right?
Apparently I have a hole in my nutsack. Other than that.
I heard about this, and I can't remember what it is.
I got nothing.
I can't believe they bleep everything except a nutsack. I guess that's a FCC accepted.
Where Bayou Billionaires has cosmetic surgery, Full Metal Jousting has nutsack womping. 3 separate groin injuries in the one episode I have seen. Full Metal Jousting. Now, this is on the History Channel.
Sure.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
For some reason, has sort of abandoned the concept of history and replaced it with shows that make Stephen Thompson look like a giant pansy. but this one is...
Shows about weapons?
It is an elimination-based reality show with much more opportunity for injury than most such shows
Full
provide.
Metal
So
jousting.
Horses? It's like... Yeah,
jousting. It's got a dollop of Renfair. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, does it take place at medieval times?
It does not. It's basically sort of like really, really rugged, you know, muscular, you know, dudes womp each other with lances while riding horses. Mm-hmm. And then like
that does sound like jousting.
Is there armor involved?
There is armor involved. Okay. Yes, there, which somehow
That's
does not
metal.
Does not adequately protect You'd one's
think.
Nutsack.
Greaves or some polygons or something.
That seems
there's
like a
word
poorly
for that,
designed
three
armor.
Lancings to the groin episode. Which, you know, I would think, given the sort of, you know, the target market for this show, presumably, is people who enjoy sort of extreme sports and sort of fantasize about their possible role in that. I don't understand the appeal of watching these dudes get walloped in the privates. It's not.
I don't know enough dudes. All right, my catsif clip.
I better see a homeless child that hasn't eaten, that hasn't bathed. In that box, act it out. And they get you, and they befriend you, and they help you, and they clean you up. You come around, you dance with the girls, and at the end, what do we see? Another homeless child, because the problem still exists. So think about that when you're in your own bedroom.
So think about that.
Tonight, going to sleep in your big, beautiful house. Yes?
Dance Moms.
That is from Dance Moms.
Yep.
1 point for Glenn Weldon.
Wow.
That was Abby Lee Miller, the horrible, mean dance coach from Dance Moms, who was explaining the routine that she had choreographed for the little girls.
Please tell me these are all 8 to 12-year-olds.
Yeah, approximately. Okay. Yeah. Where they all have like pink little dance outfits on. And one of them dresses up like she's homeless, which consists of wearing a knit hat.
Sure.
Like a knit winter hat. And a cardigan sweater with the bottom sort of cut with scissors into rags. Oh.
Like
the car wash skirts, you know, in strips at the bottom. And then the girls, she's in a box and, you know, there's a dance around the box. And then they find her and they take her out. And, of course, they take her hat off and get her out of that sweater. And that solves her homelessness problem.
Right.
And then at the very end, it turns out the stage trick is that another little girl has sneaked into the box because the problem still exists.
Yeah. Wow.
So this is Abby Lee Miller solving the homelessness problem through the power of dance.
Tiny children dance.
Pretty remarkable. Dance Moms is pretty freaking bad.
That's horrifying.
It's pretty horrifying. Lifetime recently decided to never again run the one where she had them do the dance where they were supposed to look like they're naked. And she explains
Good
that you're
God.
Supposed to look like you're naked, but you're going to have little things that you're holding up in front of your delicate parts, but the idea is to make it look like you're naked under there. Now, a lot of these girls are like 9.
Right.
It's pretty bad. But I chose the homelessness one because it was less offensive.
I just picked Nutsack Womp.
Yes, yep. Exactly. Wow. All right, Mike Katzef, clip.
Nathaniel asked me to come up here. Basically, he had something that he wanted to tell me. So I don't know exactly what it's about, but I'd like to know what's going on in his life.
Yeah, it's something pretty important I want to talk to you about.
All right.
I'm just going to come out and say it, I guess. I'm in an intimate relationship with Chase. Sexually and emotionally.
You're in an intimate relationship with your car?
Yes.
And sexually with your car?
Yes.
It's your car?
Yes.
How does that work? How can you have sex with a car?
Mainly it's just a lot of just rubbing up against it.
Because that's the first question.
I want to know that.
Right?
Any guesses?
Oh, wow.
Any guesses?
Wait, so it's not just a sexual relationship with a car. It's a gay sexual relationship with a car.
Car's name is Chase.
Chase is a him.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Is there a show? Oh, wait. My Strange Obsession.
Addiction. Yeah. So you heard the voice of Nathaniel, and he is in love with a 1998 Chevrolet Monte Carlo.
Fair enough.
Wouldn't be?
I mean, I think we can all agree that as cars go, kind of a butterface. Am I right,
right?
Monte Carlo. I mean, I can see a Trans Am. But it's T-top. So he goes on to detail just how many times he's been pulling up to the bumper. And the greatest thing about that clip, which Mike Katzef had to point out to me, was, first of all, that's his dad that he's talking to.
Right.
He's washing the hood of the car as they're talking. And as Mike pointed out, he washes and washes, but that car's never going to get clean. But the greatest thing about it is that they have blurred out the Chevy insignia on the front of the car. As if it didn't sign the release. It's awesome. So, yeah. So that's the one.
Okay.
So My Strange Addiction, this show, I have neither the ironic distance to find it funny, present company accepted, or the human empathy to care about these freaks. So I am stuck somewhere in the middle where it's just, you're just mystified. Like, A, how do the producers find these people?
Right.
B, why do these people say yes?
Why would you agree to announce to your father
on camera.
You have to get wired up for a microphone.
Well,
they both are wearing microphones.
To make it easier.
You have to sort of question whether this entire conversation is staged.
Well, I mean, yes, that thought doesn't go away. But I mean, the way I think about it is that on Survivor, you show sociopaths all the time.
Right.
Especially
this season.
Right. What American Idol be without narcissists? This show is just pointing a camera at untreated mental health issues, which is why it feels really skeevy. But that said, I recommend going to Wikipedia to read the titles of each episode, because each episode has two stories in it. So as much as
I
you
did
want...
this one time for,
right.
the,
yes,
for
you
the
did.
Game.
Yes, you did.
The
right,
game
you did.
I did. And one of them was eating the hair out of the shower
drain.
Right.
That's right. I was wondering where I...
Yep.
Okay, so yeah, Thumbsucker Bodybuilder, two different shows. Dating My Car, Baby Powder Addict.
Baby Powder Addict.
Drinking Gasoline, Smelling My Doll Head. That was a new one this season. And finally, Eats Dirt, Extreme Toenails. My point is...
Extreme Toenails.
I saw the previews for Extreme Toenails.
I forgot that you had done this. Yeah. I guess it's... Well, it's a well. You just keep going back to
it. Believe me. I understand the charm of it.
So they show him kissing the car quite often and rubbing up against it. And
did the FCC review this?
I don't know.
Or is it on cable?
No, that's why they blur. They pixelate.
It's on cable. It's on TLC.
Okay.
That's mine.
TLC.
Yeah.
The Learning Channel.
Of course it's on TLC.
Fortunately, I gave Mike an extra that we might have that we could use to cleanse our palates.
I'm questioning the viability of your whole idea. I think there may be zero value here. Absolutely nobody would buy this. I don't know why anybody would need this.
But you know what? I got to tell you, I have a dog. It's not a bad idea. It's a great way to package it.
Is there some form of patent on this?
There is. I have a patent pending, and I've also trademarked the name. You have a patent on it?
I do indeed.
Pending.
See, Blake, I think it's a good idea, because when I travel to dog, right now you got to grab this food, you got to throw it in a plastic bag. It's just a lot of work. The other thing I really like is for a large food company, it's just another way for them to sell product. Have you made any of those calls?
I have tried personally to contact a few different pet food vendors, and I have not gotten anywhere with my research.
You know why? Because it's a worthless idea.
And that would be?
It's the Sharks thing.
Shark Tank.
Show in which aspiring entrepreneurs pitch their products to investors.
Let me tell you the truth. Shark Tank is awesome.
It is kind of fun.
Shark Tank is a really compelling, weird reality show. If you have never seen it, incidentally, you have these bunch of rich investors, one of whom is Mark Cuban.
Right.
Oh, wow.
You know,
the benefactor himself.
The benefactor himself. Basically, people come in who have an invention or a company, and they try to get them to invest in it. Mm-hmm. You say, I want $100,000 for 10% of my company or something like that. And then you negotiate and you see whether they care.
Yep.
They call it Shark Tank because they refer to these investors as sharks.
Sharks. Yeah.
So the idea is these are the sharks, and you go in there in the room and you have to make your pitch. And, you know, every now and then somebody will bring them something where you'll think, that's actually a pretty good idea. I would buy that.
And
you know?
there's real money at stake here.
And
these people that do actually invest.
There's real money, and there are people who have gotten their products, you know, where you can find online that they're still selling them and that they're now in Target or whatever. And they do little updates where they show people having big success. This guy came in, and his entire idea was prepackaged trays of dog food with also a little container of water that came with it for traveling with your pet. So the idea was, it was like a TV dinner tray.
TV dinner.
Yeah. So it's like a Lunchable.
They said on the show, it's basically Lunchables for dogs. Now
but with less sodium.
Now, the problem with this, as one of the investors pointed out, is why would you not just take a plastic bag and put dog food in a plastic bag?
And a thermos.
Because it turned out he had no play in terms of like manufacturing these. That wasn't his thing. His thing was, I'm going to license the packaging like to a pet food company because I have a patent on this packaging idea.
Wow.
Pending. Yeah. So basically he got in there and he was like, so this is my idea, plastic individually wrapped dog food. And they were all like, get out.
If you love dog food but wish it were less environmentally sound.
And the funny thing is the one guy, as you heard, the one guy who is kind of one of the nicer investors, basically said, you know, I see some value in this idea. But
because never underestimate the laziness of the general public.
Yeah, but it was not a good idea.
Now, have you seen Dragon's Den, the British show that this is based on?
I have not.
It's got a better title.
But Shark Tank is really, if you're going to watch a reality show, and I'm not saying you should.
It is not a bad one.
But
if you're
going to
watch one
is,
of the five reality shows that we have just talked about.
Shark Tank's pretty good. And that brings us to the end of the regrettable television pop quiz. Mine were too easy. Hmm. I think Glenn was the only person who got one of anyone else's.
We both got Shark Tank. Shark Tank.
I feel like Glenn wins.
Glenn wins.
The important thing is that I lost.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think I lost too. All right. And the final segment of our show, as always, is What's Making You Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, in addition to actually reading a book.
Yes. Huh? Right? I know.
My kids have been exposed through the awesome power of my mother to the cartoon Adventure Time.
Yeah, right.
From the Cartoon Network.
They have,
it,
I know.
It is just absurdity after absurdity after absurdity. If your kids enjoy really wackadoodle.
Okay, for those of us who know nothing about this, tell us about the premise.
Boy. Good luck.
I don't know how well I can narrow this down. There's the dog and the human, and they have adventures, and there's, like, the Ice King and a cloud that talks like a sullen teenage girl.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And
princesses, there's a couple princesses in there.
The first thing that sort of jumps out about it is that you honestly have absolutely no idea where any given episode goes next. Episodes are 11 minutes long, and they just made my kids are 11 and 8 for those who are, you know, have kids at home or you're looking for fun things to watch with them. I always sort of decree that that any children's programming my kids enjoy have to also be enjoyable by me,
mm-hmm.
and this very much fit that bill. It's a delightful, delightful cartoon. There is at least one DVD set
right.
of Adventure Time, but there needs to be more.
Really striking design. I mean, really striking cartooning going on. Really sometimes kind of off-putting
kind
initially.
Of strangely,
kind of strange.
Kind of strangely, like, almost psychedelic
yep.
in a way.
Yep.
It's very funny. The scripts are very sharp.
Yep.
Adventure Time.
Adventure Time, making Stephen Thompson happy this week. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, one thing that is making me happy last week, which I would have told you about last week if I hadn't been busy hacking up a lung, is the Broadway production of Once. And I know that I have mentioned this thing before when it was announced that they were going to turn the movie into a stage show. But I have to admit, having had some doubts about the idea of taking this quiet, sweet little indie film, which is made, we should disclaim, as always, by a guy that Thompson knows, and turning it into a stage show. Much less taking the stage show and moving it from a smallish off-Broadway house to a bigger Broadway theater.
Mm-hmm.
But I got the chance to see it a couple of weeks ago, and it is honestly just terrific. It uses music and song and instrumentation and movement in a way that is not at all typical for a Broadway musical. It's wonderfully organic. And the way they've translated it for the stage is really inventive, oddly intimate still, and very much true to the realistic lo-fi ethic of the film. And I completely loved it.
Oh, that's great. So.
How are they able to render the horse? Oh, wait, that's War Horse.
That's War Horse, and I saw that too, and it was also very nice.
Nice.
Both of them still running in New York, so if you're making travel plans, think about that.
Very good.
And Once fans, Glenn Hansard has a record coming out in June.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. Also making me happy this week, primarily making me happy this week, Katana Swords, Chained Up Zombie Slaves, and Crazy Badass Ex-Lawyer Ladies Talking to Themselves.
And that's just Saturday night.
For fans of The Walking Dead, especially the comic, the happy-making thing this week is that Michonne is finally going to be coming to mm-hmm. the TV show. For me, it is about who got cast. It's an actress named Danai Gurira. She's a Zimbabwean-American actress and playwright. You may have seen her on Tremé, or in a small part in the film The Visitor, which starred Richard Jenkins uh-huh. and earned him an Oscar nomination. I first met Danai in 2006 when she mm-hmm. and a colleague of hers at grad school had put together a play called In the Continuum, which is about a woman from Los Angeles and a woman from Harare. And both of them had been recently diagnosed with HIV and been abandoned by the men who brought it home to them. And Danai's character was a newscaster on the Zimbabwean National TV Network, a professional whose world has just been basically destroyed. I profiled her and her writing partner on that play in the New York Times, and she was so impressive, both as a writer and an actor, that I've been following her career with some interest since. She's written another couple of plays, and when I reviewed the second one, which was about women in the Liberian Civil War, I wrote that what it had in common with the first one was that it was a deeply felt portrait of women in extremis, finding and testing their own strength. So basically the idea of her playing Michonne, who's this lawyer who's been tested by the zombie apocalypse and driven half mad, but who's still able to dominate most of the situations she finds herself in, it strikes me as very much the right casting, because not only is Danai really gorgeous and really talented, playing this kind of character and thinking about how a smart, confident woman would react under the most extreme kinds of duress is exactly what she's been doing for going on a decade. So when I heard that she'd been cast, I actually kind of squealed with glee. And so it's absolutely what's making me happy this week.
Outstanding.
I felt much the same way about Full Metal Jousting.
Perfect. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
Well, never let it be said that I don't have my finger on the pulse of things that happened 3 months ago.
Oh.
Key and Peele is a funny show, guys. Mm-hmm. Key and Peele. On Comedy Central. It premiered in January. I avoided it because both of those guys are from Mad TV. And I have pretty much lumped Mad TV as a place where, you know, catchphrase-based comedy comes from and really lame celebrity impressions. But it's really great. You don't need me to tell you. It premiered to like 2.1 million viewers, so it did really well for them. Only 6 episodes. It's over now, but it is available on Comedy Central on demand. So y'all should check it out. It's very funny.
Key and Peele.
NPR has written about it. Has covered it a couple times.
You're actually behind Morning Edition on this one.
Yeah, I know, right? I mentioned
good
that.
Lord!
We have covered it a couple times. All right. In terms of what's making me happy this week, I was pointing out to the fellas a little while ago that I have really not done a whole heck of a lot in the last, you know, 5 days since we taped this podcast, because we taped late last week, or taping, you know, beginning of this week. I wish I had more to report, but I
should I perform a comical dance for your amusement?
I was going to say, you're always what's making me happy.
Oh, Holmesy.
Who loves you,
you knucklehead?
Would you like to borrow one of my nephews?
I have nephews of my own.
Okay.
And they're quite delightful.
Okay.
I don't talk about them on their show, but it doesn't mean I don't love
them.
Who
would talk about young relatives?
Anyway,
on this show?
So I told the guys there's really only one thing that I can tell you that's legitimately possibly amusing to anyone.
Does it involve yeast?
It does. In a happy way. You know, I talked a few weeks ago about my growing adventures in baking and that I was making my own bread and everything. Here's what's making me happy this week. And I haven't got a chance to use them yet because you have to make sure you have all your ingredients in place and everything like that. Got me some English muffin rings. Mm-hmm. Going to make my own English muffins. It's one of those things where no one has any idea why you would ever do that instead of just buying them, which is why
they're like
$1.39. Which is why I like it. It's the thing on The Price is Right that you pick if it's you gotta find the cheapest thing.
Yep.
And yet, for some reason, I was fascinated by this as soon as I saw that this was a thing, that you could make your own English muffins and that you bake them in little metal rings.
It's always either the English muffins or the can of frozen orange juice.
Yep. Yeah, it's
but
true.
See, now you gotta get the machine that installs the crannies and the nooks. It's a whole thing.
I will not need to do that. It's all part of the process. Mm-hmm. I will bring you boys some English muffins at some point, homemade, and they'll be really good, and then that'll show you.
I thought that you were going to tell us that baking camp was what was going to be making.
That's true. I'm thinking about going to baking camp. There are a couple of options. You know, laugh it up, mister. I go to 8 music festivals a year and see the same bands.
Ooh, burn.
Snap!
There are a couple of different choices, but yes, I am looking at a couple of places where you can, like, go away for several days at a time and learn to make bread.
I'm actually planning to go to eating camp, but it is taking place on my couch.
I understand. Well, you never know. If I get bread camp, you might get eating camp as
nice.
A result.
Nice.
So,
somebody
you know.
Could
I'm
go.
I'm just looking forward to the anecdotes that begin with this one time.
So if somebody goes to bread camp, somebody has to go to clown college because bread and circuses.
Yeah.
Yes. Wow.
I know.
Wow. You
and with
go to...
that, we're done.
Yeah,
I think.
It's true. And that does bring us to the end of our show. As always, you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E and Graham. Exactly like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our esteemed and hardworking producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. You can find us on Facebook as well at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/monkeyc. Phew! And so thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Oh, yeah.
You.
Glad to be back.
And thanks to all of you for listening as we bring the entire group back together. And we will see you back here next week.